All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We got a packed show for you today, all right? We have a special surprise in the middle of the show, but I'm going to start with what the back end of the show is going to be. At the back end of the show, we're going to be listening to a segment from a talk given by Bob Avakian a number of years ago called BA Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less. And this particular segment is extremely important today for all those people that are out there wrestling with what the hell they should be doing in the face of these elections. Should they vote with the Democrats in order to oppose the fascist Trump? Or what should they do? And this piece by Avakian is putting it pretty clear, right? It wants people to understand what's going on when you get out there and you take part in their voting system, all right? It's the election hustle. If they draw you in, they win. But opening the show up, we have a very special segment we're going to do because it's just this damn important, all right? It's important. It's about Flint, Michigan and what's going on there. And Alan Goodman, who's, you know him, he's been a guest on the show a number of times. He's a reporter, a writer for Revolution Newspaper and Revcom.us. And Alan's going to be talking with us about the deliberate poisoning of the people of Flint, Michigan. He recently spent several days there talking to people from every walk of life and observing and analyzing what the hell's going on. And he's bringing it to us, all right? Alan, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. Good to be here.
Yeah, well, let's jump into this because I got so much to ask you. And I know there's tons of people who have all kinds of things. Like I said, you recently spent some time in Flint, and once famous for auto production, now famous for, killing its population. You were there. You spent some time there digging into things, talking to all kinds of people. Why don't you give us a little background and overview of what you found?
Well, I'm not sure how closely your listeners have been following the whole situation. Briefly recap that first. About 2 years ago, Flint, and we'll get into the state of the city of Flint, how it went from a city of 200,000 to 100,000, and went from about 80,000 relatively high-paying jobs at General Motors to 5,000 General Motors jobs today, and how it became a bankrupt city later on in the segment. But all of that set the stage for a decision 2 years ago to switch the city's water supply from the safe, stable, reliable water they had been getting for 50 years to the incredibly polluted Flint River. And I think we'll get into how that river became so polluted as well before we're done, because it's all part of the picture. But at that point, immediately, the water was brown, it smelled bad, it tasted bad. The people who I spoke to in Flint who had the resources to do so at that point immediately switched to privately supplied water filters, but many people didn't have the resources to do that. In fact, I heard this just heartbreaking, infuriating story when I interviewed Michael Pitt. He, no relation to Michael Slate. He, or Brad Pitt, for that matter. But he is the attorney, the lead attorney in a civil suit representing victims of the lead poisoning in Flint. And he told me the story of one of his clients, a grandmother, who in order to encourage her grandbabies to drink a healthy amount of water, disguised the bad taste with Kool-Aid and sugar, only to learn very recently that one of the things in the water that was contributing to it being so unpleasant was an extremely toxic substance, lead poisoning. The government insists that, or government regulations, say that 15 units, and I can't remember what that unit measurement is, but just for comparison, that 15 of those units are unsafe. And children are particularly vulnerable to lead poisoning because their brains are in development, and lead poisoning interferes with the development of their brain and causes permanent brain damage. So one of the, and I won't go into all the chemistry of it, although it's going into quite a bit in our coverage at Revcom.us, the Revolution newspaper, including in the interview with Michael Pitt. But 15 parts per billion is considered parts of lead per billion in water is considered dangerous. There were and are today readings from homes in Flint over 10,000 parts per billion of lead. That is not just like hazardous waste. That is hazardous waste. And for months, that was coming out of people's taps. They were not notified of the danger. Repeated attempts by scientists at Virginia Tech by activists in the ACLU, by a pediatrician in the city of Flint who was noting alarming lead levels in the children she was testing, by activist parents were discounted, were dismissed, were ridiculed, were marginalized. One government official, when the Virginia Tech people came out to Flint, and this is a very interesting experience, students from around the world who go to Virginia Tech, including from third world countries, went to Flint and were astounded by the fact that people didn't have safe water in a city in a country this rich. And they tested the water, and they determined that it was dangerously poisoned with lead, and some government official dismissed them by saying, oh, wherever they go, they pull that lead poisoning thing out of the hat. It's like a rabbit out of a hat magic trick. He was referring to the fact that they had previously exposed lead poisoning in the Washington, D.C. water supply. So this situation was, you know, again, covered up and dismissed until the authorities were utterly unable to sweep it under the rug any further. And at that point, they began the most minimalist things, like, you know, making donated bottled water available. And I think we'll get to this. I know we'll get to this. But one of the things I discovered is that there is a very large section of the population of Flint, poor black people, who are so physically and otherwise isolated, marginalized, demonized, and cut off from access to information and social services that even the minimal things that have been implemented are not solving the problem for them. At this point, the city has installed water filters, but with proper maintenance and testing and education, they're not effective. So this is the situation. The crime continues. So that's a backdrop to the situation. And then, as you noted, our coverage has identified that what happened was a conscious, callous policy of a racist capitalist genocidal system. And then there was the reporter's notebook that I did on how the North Side ghetto became ground zero for this lead poisoning. And we've been discussing, and there's been an exchange in the pages of Revolution over how a socialist society could and would address something that this system cannot and will not. So that's kind of an overview. And what were you asking?
Let me ask you a couple questions off of this, because I was talking to somebody yesterday, and they were actually, one of the things they posed, and I think you're answering a lot of it, but one of the things that they posed to me was, they said, you know, and it fits with what I hope, yes, we will get into what a socialist society would do in a situation like this towards the back end of our conversation. But basically, the government there has done nothing in terms of an overview of a plan or mobilizing any kind of real sort of action plan to deal with this, have they?
Well, one way to answer that is to go back to the Democratic debate last week, or was it this week, earlier this week? They have so many, but I think it was last weekend in Flint. And at that debate, Leanne Waters, who is the mother of at least one child who is suffering very badly from lead poisoning, was given the microphone and asked both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, will you make a personal promise, and I'm quoting her now, to me right now as president, in your first 100 days in office, you will make it a requirement that all public water systems must remove all lead service lines throughout the entire United States and notification made to the citizens that have said service lines. And essentially, you know, and I'll just read the answers so nobody thinks I'm mischaracterizing. Bernie Sanders said, I will make a personal promise to you that the EPA and the EPA director that I appoint will make sure that every water system in the United States is tested and that the people in those communities know the quality of the water that they are drinking, and that we are going to have a plan to rebuild water systems in this country that are unsafe for drinking. In other words, no, I will not make that commitment. And then Anderson Cooper interjected, by the way, there's 10 million lead service pipes, which are the source of the lead poisoning. The lead poisoning problem is bigger than lead service pipes that run from people's homes to the central, you know, the pipe that runs down the street in your neighborhood. But Anderson Cooper said there's 10 million lead service pipes. In other words, you're not really going to deal with that, are you? 10 million. And then Clinton just said she agreed with Sanders. So here you have the representatives of the Democrats. There are two candidates. They go to Flint with the stated purpose of showing how much they care. And when asked if in their first 100 days in office they can make it a requirement to remove all the lead service pipes throughout the entire United States. So this does pose big questions about the nature of the system. How did we get into this situation? What's responsible for it? And, you know, and the basic answer to your question is pretty much yes. Even after all the exposure, all the outrage, all the statements of who we really care, it is what you said. The system has no fundamental response to the situation in Flint. And as many people pointed out, this lead poisoning in the water in Flint, which is going on right now as we speak, is the tip of the iceberg nationwide.
Well, let's jump into this. You mentioned earlier, you brought up as you began to talk, you brought up the situation in the north side of Flint. And you were talking about the Flint River. You were talking about the rest of this. But the north side is the black side of town. Let's talk about the differences between there and the rest of Flint. What happened in the north side?
Well, in a sense, that's a long story. I forget how you kicked off the interview. You said something along the lines of the deliberate poisoning of people. And I think it's, in some ways, it's important to distinguish that there were conscious decisions made, but there was also sort of just the blind, anarchic working of the capitalist system that converged to bring about the crisis in Flint itself. And then the particularly, you know, ground zero, as I put it in the reporter's notebook, the particularly extreme situation in the north side of Flint, which is not just a black community, but a community where very poor black people live. Flint is a majority black city, and the north side is not the majority of the city. So there's different dimensions to this. But, you know, we've got a little time, and I think we can tell the story because it does shed light on how things got to be this way and why this kind of thing is inherent in capitalism. I mean, the article I wrote turned out to be, you know, I went to Flint, I experienced the North Side. It was, for somebody like who hasn't been in the Rust Belt lately, and I know you're out there on one coast and I'm calling from another, but you know, for people who haven't really experienced the Rust Belt, it is a visceral stunner. Just the massive abandonment from the Iron Range in Minnesota to Buffalo and everywhere in between, the massive abandonment of steel mills, auto plants, and rubber factories and iron mines and shipping. It's just, it does have kind of a surreal, you know, science fiction-y feel. And then you have the humans who have been cast off by this process. So there was that whole kind of visceral impact of walking around the north side of Flint where many, many, many blocks, abandoned homes outnumber inhabited ones. And so that's the visceral, the human side of it. And it was very stunning. And I shared an exchange I had with a woman I spoke with, whose husband had worked decades at General Motors. And she told me, black people put this country on wheels, and now that they suck the life out of us, they don't care about us. And in the reporter's notebook, I note that she's right, and that the thing is, the people who run this system couldn't do things differently, even if they wanted to. And that is really what I set out to dig into in this article, you know, using Flint as a case study, in a sense.
I want to get into that right now, but I want to ask you just one more thing around this north side. Is that, was there a measurable difference in the treatment that the north side got in relation to the rest of Flint?
There was, and it's one of these interesting things where the limitations of using equality as your measure of how to change the world, because in a certain sense, it's like the, what's that old quote from the French radical poet? I think it was a radical bourgeois poet, but, you know, the rich and the poor are equally prohibited from sleeping under a bridge. Is that, in other words, the city did distribute filters to everyone in the city of Flint, but people with resources, and they suffered terribly as well. I mean, some of them, their children were brain damaged. In fact, there's this kind of famous email that came out that the governor had seen, and I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but basically a nurse said to one of these parents, and this was a parent who had more resources, not someone on the north side, and was very concerned about the brain damage caused by lead poisoning in their water, which, just to emphasize, did affect white, black, Arab, Latino, you know, it did affect the city broadly. But this parent was told by a nurse, it's just a few IQ points, it's not the end of the world. And that's the kind of mentality that comes from seeing people as nothing more than, if you can't exploit them, what's the point? So I drifted off into that to make the point that the whole city got subjected to lead poisoning, but conditions on the north side made that much, much worse. The people whose doors we knocked on, I went door to door in the neighborhood with someone in the Revolution Club, taking out Revolution newspaper, letting people bounce off some of the things in there and learning from their experiences. But people had no access to any of the resources, scarce as they were, that were available. For example, you can get a lead poisoning test at fire stations. But the nearest fire station was a mile away in 10-degree weather. There's no meaningful public transportation in Flint. And how is a mother going to bring young children without a car to that fire station? We talked to one guy who had somehow managed to make it up to a fire station. This was on the north side. But, you know, it had been 2 weeks and he hadn't heard back on whether or not he had lead poisoning. So the same lead poisoning hit people, and it seems that there may well be a disproportionate amount of these dangerous lead pipes in the north side because people haven't, you know, rehabbed their homes or whatever. So there, you know, there was in some ways, there's formal equality in terms of what resources you can get at, but extreme inequality in the way this crisis has come down.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Alan Goodman, who's a writer for Revolution Newspaper and RevCom.us, and we're talking about the poisoning of the people in Flint, Michigan, the lead poisoning in the water. Now, Alan, tell me this. You know, you mentioned this earlier. You talked about the anarchic, the side of the system and what that has to do with how things play out, how things roll out. And you also talk about in your article, you make a point that, you mentioned this earlier too, that the system, you say, okay, while it's true that people who run the system don't care about what's happening, even if they did care, they couldn't do anything differently. And I wanted you to explain that because that does have a lot to do with what you were talking about in terms of the anarchic character of the system, right?
Right. I mean, the underlying factors behind this crisis in Flint, and you can extrapolate from this and apply it to cities all around the country, but the city has been devastated by economic changes and that have taken place in the last few decades. And what has kind of torn up people's lives is exactly this anarchic working of capitalism. You know, I tried to explain that in a kind of concentrated way at one point and then go into how it actually came down in Flint. But the concentrated explanation was that under this capitalist system, every capitalist, like General Motors, which built Flint, competes with other capitalists around the world. They're all driven by the law, expand or die, to beat out rivals or go under. And to do that, they're driven to continually cheapen costs in order to stay alive. And that means devastating the environment. I mean, the Flint River was and is used as a toxic waste dump by General Motors, an externality to the process of accumulating profit, as capitalist academics put it, that is, speaking of the environment. They abandoned factories to rust. They moved production around the world. all in search of the lowest, most exploitive wages and leaving millions of people behind without a means to survive. But these are the rules of the system. You know, this is why we really need a revolution. And this is why we really dig into, in other articles at RevCom, how a socialist society, not in a utopian way. People should go to RevCom and read an exchange around this where a letter writer posts, let's really look realistically at the, you know, on the one hand, a socialist system will be free of everything I just said, that, you know, resources won't be allocated in order to find the most viciously, you know, the way to most viciously exploit labor. But they will be finite, and there will be struggle in society over how they should be allocated, including contradictions between moving society to ending all exploitation and oppression and a world free of that, and people who aren't for that. And who, you know, won't be just coerced in socialist society. Anyway, I really encourage people to read that exchange of letters, but that's not the mode of production. That's not the economic system. That's not the way the things are made, produced, and distributed, and the logic behind that in the system we have. And that's the problem. And then you have the values and outlooks that arise on the basis of that capitalist system and become the dominant outlook in society, infecting everything. That's where you get a nurse telling a mother, it's just a few IQ points, it's not the end of the world. That's where, when it comes time for the freeway to be built through Flint, guess what? It splits the north side ghetto from the rest of the city. There's urban removal that disrupts the community. There's a freeway that's hard to cross that makes the poor black people even more isolated and subjected to more intense repression. So this is, you know, this is the workings of a system. And a big theme that I tried to emphasize in the reporter's notebook is, in the most fundamental sense, that's all a product of the system working, regardless of the desires of the people who run the society. You know, these are the laws of capitalism, and that's how the crisis in Flint developed. And then there's the whole dimension of how did the North Side ghetto become ground zero for lead poisoning, which I think is a very critical part of the story and reveals a lot about the nature of the society.
You know, it's interesting because when you're talking about that, and I do want to talk about that now, and one of the things that you bring out in your piece is you do talk about this sort of relationship between the anarchy that you've been talking about as well as the white supremacy that has actually been promoted and developed in Flint. You know, it's heavy because a lot of people, when they think of Flint, Michigan, we were talking about this the other day, a lot of people, you know, like Michael Moore, the Social Democrats, all these people talk about this was the workers' place. You know, this is where people actually, it was like the down to the earth, the, you know, just the common people, the good common people. And then you have this interplay between the anarchy of the system and white supremacy that's been promoted and taken up in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I mean, you know, what I do in the article is sort of trace how, due to all kinds of factors that weren't cooked up by some genius or visionary or whatever, this whole kind of industrial belt developed from the Minnesota Iron Range to the end of the Great Lakes, where steel and tires and cars were produced and shipped out of. Coal was shipped in, and then as the global economy changed, that all kind of fell apart. But that's the emergence of the city of Flint as the headquarters for General Motors, and where they had almost 100,000 people building cars, took place in a society profoundly stamped by the oppression of black people. Seems like periodically I just sort of reflect back on the very first quote in the book Basics from the writings of Bob Avakian. There would be no United States as we know it today without slavery. That is a simple and basic truth. And I really saw this reflected. First of all, the workers who immigrated from Eastern and Southern Europe to work in Flint, they were discriminated against and suffered different forms of persecution. But when they got to the United States, they got conditioned that they were no longer Slavs or Ukrainians or Poles or Italians or Jews. They were white Americans. And from, you know, the moment they arrived in Flint, there was sort of, you know, two tracks. For the white workers, there was a General Motors Institute to train them to be skilled workers, and was part of sort of institutionalizing upward mobility. You know, so you may be working in a factory, but your son could become an engineer or an administrator. So there was the General Motors Institute. General Motors built housing for white workers, and I saw these homes. They're pretty nice. You know, they're solid Midwestern homes, three-bedroom homes, and they sold them to them cheaply, and you signed a contract, a formal legal contract, that you would not, guess what? Guess what was in the contract that white workers signed when they got these nice homes from General Motors?
That it would always stay in nice, pure white hands.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That they would only be sold to Caucasians. Meanwhile, north of the Flint River, which General Motors used as a toxic waste dump, much lower quality housing was built. And as the city evolved, the north side got more and more isolated. It's cut off by this toxic waste dump, the Flint River. I mentioned that when it was time for freeway construction, let's just, you know, have it cut across town and isolate the north side, all kind of embedded into things. And all of this has had a profound and very bad impact on the mentality of, you know, white America, getting people to identify with their interests, getting, you know, too many white people to identify their interests as being aligned with those of the system, and resenting and seeing black people and other minorities as, you know, people who they somehow are entitled to live better than. So that all puts a stamp on this water crisis and the way it's come down. And points from another angle to why the system could not uproot and fundamentally deal with this situation, you know, in any kind of meaningful way, because there's no way around it other than addressing, you know, the legacy of white supremacy and how deeply bound up that is with the whole history and culture and mentality of this society. And I will just add, you know, it's kind of a perceptual comment, but for your listeners who have been following the situation closely in Flint, has anybody else written about how this crisis is extremely concentrated in the North Side ghetto? We interact with our coverage at RevCom. I want to point out a couple things. There is a comment link at the end of all of our articles, and we're interested in what you think of them. And there's also, by the way, a volunteer link. So if doing the research into the kind of articles that we're talking about here, and in the process of trying to get to the bottom of what makes all this tick, you know, intrigues you, click that volunteer button and we'll find a place for you.
All right.
So anyway, I did want to emphasize this North Side situation that you asked about, and how that does concentrate how deeply bound up white supremacy is with the nature of the society. And then that poses some of the questions that are wrestled with in the coverage of how a socialist society would deal with this, because uprooting that legacy would obviously be a very important part of what that society was trying to do as part of getting to a world free of all oppression and exploitation. And let's face it, that's going to be contentious in a socialist society, because we will inherit a lot of the prejudices and thinking that, you know, exist in this society.
Now, we've got about 5 minutes left, and I want you to talk about how would a socialist society take care of this kind of situation, deal with this situation?
First of all, I think maybe let's just establish that this would require a revolution, and that's, you know, there's a strategy for that revolution at RevCom.us. There is a vision for a new kind of society in the Constitution for a New Socialist Republic in North America, which is the blueprint for that new society, written by Bob Avakian, and again, available at railcom.us. And so the reason that I emphasize all that is that the measures, you know, there would be immediate measures taken to address this crisis, that the society's resources would be mobilized, volunteers would be encouraged, information gotten out in Spanish and Arabic. There are people who only speak those languages in Flint who have been essentially locked out of things. There would be a mobilization of nurses and doctors and nutritionists, and again, you know, calls for volunteers, as well as allocating society's resources. And the situation that exists now, where 2 years almost going on after the revelations that this water is unfit to drink, there are still people whose water is toxic, you know, the toxic waste is coming out of their tap water. That would not go on for 2 years. That could be solved, if not literally overnight, in a very short time span. You know, it would be a challenging thing. It would require, there's actually a lot of people doing important work on this. There are people doing work on how nutrition and special ed can be provided to children whose brains have been affected by lead poisoning. There's another dimension to things. The north side of Flint is what is referred to in official government parlance as a food desert, meaning that the only stores that people can get to are liquor stores. They're few and far between. Oh, it's just, you know, it's just stunning how difficult it is to get to any fresh fruit, vegetables, all the kinds of healthy foods that are recommended for children who've been exposed to lead poisoning. So that's another dimension that would have to be addressed. There's engineering challenges. Very, very, very poor records were kept, if at all, of who has lead pipes. So there needs to be engineering innovations to work on that. So that's one dimension of things. But the other dimension of things is that there would be, you know, there would not be unlimited resources. What resources a socialist society would have would not be constrained by how do we beat out rivals and make the most profit by exploiting people most viciously. But there would be limited resources. This will not be a country that where, you know, people make our clothes in sweatshops in Bangladesh and grow our coffee in Ethiopia. This would be a country with radically different economic structure that wasn't based on feeding off the rest of the world. There would be all kinds of challenges. And again, and I've been alluding to this, and this is something that's emphasized in this letter that a reader wrote responding to our article, How a Socialist State Power Would Handle a Water Crisis in Flint. And they pose that in Bob Avakian's most recent work, The Science, the Strategy, the Leadership for an Actual Revolution and a Radically New Society on the Road to Real Emancipation, there's emphasis on the fact that there will always be necessity and not unlimited resources and forces in society who would be seizing on an emergency like Flint to create chaos. There would be struggle over where would society's resources go. You know, there will not be, and it's, you know, an anti-communist stereotype, but it's also something that Bob Avakian has done further work on, that there would not be some big brother just ordering everybody to Flint. You know, there would be policies of a socialist state that would send resources there, but there would also be struggle in society, even over questions like, you know, here's a question, do you just fix up the north side, or, you know, do you address the fact, you know, how do you address the fact that there is a north side in Flint? And how do you even look at the ghettos in this country and work through how to address that inequality in the context of getting to a world without any exploitation or oppression? So I'm trying to say that on the one hand, on a very basic level, everybody would get water. There would be, you know, immediate attention to people's health and education needs. And at the same time, there would be ferments and struggle in society over how to address this and how it related to what's wrong with the world and how it needs to change. So you know, it would be a very vibrant process and one that could, in a real serious way, address people's needs.
All right, Alan, thank you very much for joining us today. I really appreciate it. And I want people to definitely go to revcom.us and read your piece near your reporter's notebook, a very, very important piece. And thank you again, man.
Okay, great. Yeah, and check out, you know, the whole range of coverage that we've got at the site of Flint and share it.
Okay. All right, Alan, thanks. Right. We'll have you back again soon. Take care.
Okay, bye.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Alan Goodman, writer for Revolution Newspaper and RevCom.us, about the situation in Flint. We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned. That was Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead from the movie The Wizard of Oz. And apparently that's the original Munchkin cast singing that tune. And that goes out to Nancy Reagan. That's right, that Nazi monster that's being praised and celebrated all across the country these days. And she does represent this country very well, represented her husband and all of his criminal ventures and the entire system in this country. And remember, folks, these crimes included things like throwing mental patients out into the streets, supporting Islamic fundamentalists in Afghanistan, arming genocidal regimes in the Central American countries of El Salvador and Guatemala, and illegally arming terror squads in Nicaragua, supporting the apartheid regime in South Africa, and cutting help for the poor in the U.S. in order to build a giant stockpile of nuclear weapons as the U.S. prepared for World War III. Yes, indeed, Nancy Reagan is certainly something that this system would celebrate, but we should certainly not shed any tears over the death of such a fascist monster. And now here's Bob Avakian with the election hustle. If they draw you in, they win.
This system we now live under creates the illusion of freedom and individual responsibility. But what is the reality? We're always told that the great thing about this system is that it's founded on and gives the highest priority to the sanctity of the individual. This is what makes this system, and this is above all what makes America so great. Well, what is the truth? The truth is that the individuality of literally billions of people counts for nothing under this system. Literally billions of individuals are ground up and pulverized by the workings and the forcible dictates of this system. Where is the sanctity of their individuality? Let's ask some pointed questions. Why do tens of millions of black people happen to be in this country? And why are they catching hell here in the ways they are every day? And why are masses of people who are still in Africa still catching hell there? Is this all a matter of personal responsibility and personal choices, or is it the operation of a system? Why are millions and millions of immigrants in many parts of the world leaving their homes and homelands and traveling, often thousands of miles, desperately searching for a better life or simply a way to stay alive? Is this fundamentally a matter of personal choices or because of wars and other conditions to which they are forcibly and murderously subjected? Why are so many women trapped in abusive relationships, while millions of young women and girls are trafficked as sex slaves? Is this because of personal choices, or is it something bigger and more basic? The operation of a quite literally people-devouring system and its fundamental dynamics and oppressive relations. Let's return now to the question of elections under this system. Not so much what just happened in the just concluded election, But once again, the larger picture into which this fits, and the basic role of elections under the system. Here I'm reminded of an experience I had back in Berkeley in the 1960s. I was a student at Berkeley, and then I dropped out to become a political activist, and soon, although I didn't know it right then, was to become a revolutionary and a communist. But as a political activist, I went back to Berkeley, and I walked onto the campus one afternoon to meet with some people politically, and I noticed that besides the usual knots of people arguing politically, there was another group off to the side where a lot of commotion seemed to be going on. And I walked over to see what this is about, and it turned out that there was a guy there doing the three-card Monte hustle. And I guess he'd come up to the campus because he figured, well, you know, these students all think they're smart. They think they're going to outsmart me, so I can probably make a lot of money up there. And sure enough, these students were donating money hand over fist to this guy. So I watched for a while, and then I had to get over to San Francisco. At first, I had to go to my meeting, then I had to get to San Francisco. But it turned out the meeting was canceled. So I got on a bus to go to San Francisco. Didn't have my car that day. And as the bus is about ready to pull away, who should come running up and get on the bus but the three-card Monte hustler? And he looked around at the bus, and he saw one of the few white people there, so he figured I must be a good mark, too. So he came up to me and started to draw me in to play the three-card Monte. I said, no, I'm not getting involved in that. So he kept trying to persuade me, and finally, just to try to get rid of him, I said, look, I know how this works. And he said, oh, you know how it works. Then you ought to be able to really play it well. You ought to be able to take all my money. So, we went back and forth a little more, and then finally, now I know the line is going to get rid of him. I said, look, man, I know this is a hustle. He said, oh, you're a hustler. You ought to really be able to play this game better than anybody else. So this went on and on a couple more times, and finally I just threw up my hands and I said, okay, man, you win, but I ain't playing. Now, I know this is going to sound like Jesse Jackson, but if you think about applying this to the elections and all the ways they try to get you in, one angle or another, you know if you don't take part in this, then you're going to be the loser. You got to be part of this or you have no right to say anything. Come on, play. You can win. So I have to say a little bit like Jesse Jackson, if you play, you think you choose, but when they get you to play, you lose. If they draw you in, they win. And you can ask yourself, why do they spend so much effort trying to get you to be part of this process? Because it trains you to think and to narrow your thinking to the confines of the system, and it involves you in a process of giving a stamp of approval to all the horrendous things they're doing in a society in the world. Well, you must have wanted that. You voted for somebody who's doing it now. Now, I know there's a situation in this country in particular that has to be taken into account in relation to all this. And that's the fact that through all the horrific oppression of black people in this country, up until the 1960s, one of the main forms of oppressing them was denying them the right even to be able to vote. And people lost their lives fighting for the right to vote. And if we see, as we are seeing, attempts to take away that right to vote, of course we'd have to oppose that and fight that, because it's part of trying to reinforce the oppression. But it's also important that we struggle with people to develop the knowledge and sophistication to draw the distinction between having the right to do something and actually doing it if it's not in your interest, as it isn't to vote for the rulers of this system in one form or another. You know, for example, you can make an analogy to the right to divorce. The right to divorce is very important for women in particular to be able to get out of abusive or just oppressive relations, or relations they just don't want, that they find suffocating. That's why you see Christian fascist fundamentalists trying to make divorce illegal or much more difficult to get, and making some headway in various states like Louisiana and so on. Now, that right is very important. It's a blow against the oppression of women. But we don't go around telling every woman you should divorce your husband. Some should. You know, and maybe we would give some that advice. But we're not going around saying every woman should get divorced because you have the right to do it. We're saying you have to use judgment. Is it in your interest? Is it in the best interest of larger things for you to do that or not? It's the same thing with the right to vote. Is voting for the politicians of the ruling class in your interest or not? No, it is not. So you have to develop, while upholding and fighting against to take away the right to vote, you have to develop the judgment, the wisdom, the sophistication to know that you shouldn't be voting for the politicians they bring forward for you to vote for under this system. Because it's this ruling class that completely controls the electoral process. Who decides who are the candidates that run? Somebody with power and money already, who plays a major role in the system already, gets behind these candidates or moves against them. The media decide who's presented in a positive light and who's presented in a negative light, whose scandal will be blared all over the place, and whose scandal will be suppressed. These same ruling class forces decide who is a legitimate candidate and who is not. What is a legitimate issue and what is not? How did Barack Obama get to be a major candidate for president? Because he went out and stumped all over the country talking to small groups of people? Come on. He was groomed by forces. Many of them, it seems, centered back in the state of Illinois. You remember in 2004 when he was just a state senator? He got up there in the Democratic convention and gave this stirring speech. There's not a red states of America. There's not a blue states of America. There's just the United States of America. Wow. How brilliant, insightful, and inspiring. But that was an audition of his. Can he pull this off? Can he sound like he's saying something profound while he's talking dribble? Can he get people, more, even more importantly, can he get people to identify with the dominant relations and ways of thinking? And can you get people to go along with the idea that we're all in this together, covering over the tremendous divisions and all the oppression involved with those divisions in the society? And if he'd flopped there, you wouldn't have heard about him again unless he could recoup. This is the way elections go. I think of the movie Bulwer. Some of you may remember this. Warren Beatty. He played, you know, it didn't get out the full picture. It wasn't fully scientific, but it had some interesting insights. Warren Beatty played this senator who was running for re-election. He was no good, a philanderer, an asshole in general. But he lost his mind and got much better. And in losing his mind, he saw some of the truth. So while he's in this altered state, which was much better, he went to a candidate's night. And he's out of it, you know, he's just kind of talking to himself, dancing around, so on. And then finally he sits down, and one of these people, you know, like at the debates, one of these news people asks him a question. And he breaks up, cracks up laughing. And he says, "This is really hysterical. The same people that pay us are paying you to ask us the questions." And this, in a nutshell, while it doesn't capture everything, gets to a lot of how these elections actually work and how you're drawn into the, metaphorically, to the three-card Monty game. Because that's the point. The process of elections draws people into thinking and acting on the terms of and within the killing confines of this system, which this capitalist, this bourgeois dictatorship, and its politicians and functionaries serve. And this makes it appear that the politicians, especially when you don't like what they do, that they simply do what they do just to get elected, and because they are corrupted and bought off, rather than the deeper reality that, as corrupt as they may be and are in many, many cases, fundamentally they do what they do because of the basic nature and dynamics of the system, the way it operates, and the way it has to and is bound to operate. Now, I've used this example before, including in a talk, "Birds Cannot Give Birth to Crocodiles, But Humanity Can Soar Beyond the Horizon." You would think that in any decent society, one of the most basic rights of the people would be the right to eat. But think about it. Under this system, there is no such right. If you want to eat, you have to be able to find somebody that will hire you and exploit you. You have to earn money from doing that, and you have to have enough money to go to the store and buy the food. You can't just cut out the middleman, go right to the store and say, give me the food. And think about what would happen if whole groups of people got together and marched down to one of these big supermarkets and said, we don't give a fuck about your right to make profit. We have a more fundamental right, the right to eat. So give us the food. You know what would happen. The state, the police, and so on would come out, arrest people, and shoot some of them down, which is exactly what happened in places like New Orleans during Katrina, when everything broke down and people were going getting food, not just for themselves, but to try to help out other people, including youth continually denounced as thugs and all the rest. And they were shot by the police, denounced as looters. Because according to this system, there is no right to eat. You won't find it in the Constitution. Whether you can eat or not depends on whether what you do fits into the dynamics of the system. And on a much bigger scale, in an overall sense, the same applies to what the politicians do and can't do, will and won't do. And they keep tricking people, making them think they can change this, but you can't change the basic rules and dynamics of the system. And I do have to say to people who keep willfully allowing themselves to be bamboozled in this way, at some point, Charlie Brown, you're going to have to recognize that Lucy's going to pull the football out, okay? Now, another aspect of these elections is the great icon that we always hear about at election time especially. You know what I'm talking about. The middle class. The middle class is the middle. Romney's not for the middle class. Obama's for the middle class. Obama has betrayed the middle class. Romney's for the middle class. The middle class, the middle class, the middle class. The people beneath the middle class are completely invisible and must go unmentioned. Now, why? Is it because the middle class really is this, you know, are the deciders? No, it's because the middle class is important to the people who run things in order to maintain a certain stability for the system. But it is not the middle class that decides the direction of society or what the government will do. That is decided by the ruling class in conformity with the basic nature and functioning and dynamics of the system. And the fact is, when people keep voting for the political representatives of this system, with many even voting for those politicians who openly and aggressively argue for the worst kinds of things, it makes it appear that change, and in particular, really radical change for the better, is impossible, because it seems so many people don't want it and want the opposite. The terms are all wrong in these elections. Are many people's taxes too high? Yes, they are. Is this small businessman being suffocated by regulations that corporations can get away with ignoring or passing on to customers? Of course they are. But these are all the wrong terms, and they turn things people against each other because they constantly turn them back to arguments on the ground and on the terms of the system. It's necessary to break out of this whole framework and these terms in order to have a chance at repolarizing things in society, winning over people, including people who are going in a bad direction, to a positive direction, to being involved in, or at least supportive of, radical change in the right direction. In this context, I think of experience that I had way back in the 60s in Richmond, or North Richmond to be more specific. I wrote about some of this in my memoir, From Ike to Mao and Beyond. Once again, there was another case where the police had murdered a black youth in North Richmond. And the Black Panther Party had a series of rallies out in North Richmond protesting this and rallying people against it and against the system. And after one of these rallies was breaking up, I was standing in a knot of people talking to several members of the Black Panther Party. And this middle-aged white guy came up whom today we would identify as a Tea Party type guy. And he came up to this knot of people I was part of and said, "Hey," particularly to the Black Panther members, "come here, I want to show you something." And he pulled out some books and he showed how the government was f***ing him over. And it was very interesting because he, in these circumstances, was drawn to the Black Panther Party because he could sense that they represented something radical and serious standing up against the system. Now, I don't want to make too much out of one example, but this, in fact, is not a completely isolated example. I know many people who, back in that time, when I was in college, for example, and the election was held between Johnson and Goldwater, I know many people way back then who voted for Goldwater, who were Goldwater conservatives, who by the end of that school year were radical leftists. Because of the influence of the times generally and of forces coming forward, including from among black people but others, the Black Panthers, the Brown Berets, women, so on later, the gay liberation struggle, all these kind of things shook society, but they also established a pole of radical opposition from a good direction that people who were disaffected were drawn to, even with lots of contradictions. The point being that we cannot repolarize and win over people by looking within and working within the framework that the system gives us. And in fact, doing so constantly demoralizes people and makes them believe there's no prospect for radical change and no ability to win people over.
All right, that was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, with the election hustle: if they draw you in, they win. And you can find that by going to revcom.us. And the Bob Avakian tab there will take you right to the Bob Avakian page, where you can find all kinds of things from Bob Avakian, all kinds of works. All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of our guests today: Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party; Alan Goodman from Revolution Newspaper and the site revcom.us. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistants, Jeff Pryor and Alex Brenner, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And I really want to hear from you about this pretty controversial stuff that's going on around elections, about the kind of society that we live in that would allow things like the water poisoning of the people in Flint. All right, so let's keep that back and forth going. And we're going to go out now with War on the Palaces from Refused. Talk to you again next week.